Hello and welcome to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. In this edition of the New York Times Magazine for November 24th, 2024, the cover story, County Line, 2 weeks in the life of Pennsylvania's Luzerne County, one of the many places that shifted to the right in this year's election. And then following this article, Appetite for Disruption. Big food has hacked our taste buds for decades, but now the industry is facing a new and fearsome foe, Ozempic. But first, County Line. This article was written by Philip Montgomery and Michael Sokolov. Luzerne County is one of the many counties in Pennsylvania and across the country that shifted to the right this year. We spent 2 weeks there before and after the election to understand what's driving these changes. On the Sunday before the election, the state chapter of Bikers for Trump organized a ride of 100 motorcycles in Luzerne County. They planned to travel from just outside Wilkes-Barre to Scranton, President Biden's hometown in neighboring Lackawanna County. This northeast corner of Pennsylvania used to be called coal country. Today, the largest private employers are warehouses, including facilities for Amazon, TJ Maxx, and the pet supplies retailer Chewy. The politics of the area have also shifted. For two decades, its voters reliably leaned Democratic, but Donald Trump won the county in 2016 and again 4 years later, both times by solid margins. Dwayne McDavitt, a retired prison guard and a Bikers for Trump leader, is one of the more visible local backers of the former president. Before the rally in Scranton, he explained that he doubted the results of the 2020 election because he simply did not believe Trump could have lost fairly. Tell me how Joe Biden could get 81 million votes. But Democrats hoped they could move the county back in their direction and made an intensive effort to do so. In the weeks ahead of the election, busloads of Democratic canvassers fanned out across Luzerne County. Kevin Krynak, a Luzerne County native, traveled from his home in California to try to get out the vote. He hit his 100th mile of canvassing in 40 Fort outside Wilkes-Barre. "I'm going to walk until my legs fall off," he said. County officials were vigilant leading up to Election Day. Luzerne County became a hotbed of election denialism in 2020, and Pennsylvania is an open carry state. Some people feared voters might bring guns to the polls. Election workers were told they could bring their own guns. The night before the election, a group of campaign volunteers organized by Jennifer Ziemba, the wife of the Luzerne County Republican Party chairman, gathered at Ziemba's home in Harvey's Lake, a prosperous community outside Wilkes-Barre. They were calling Republican voters whose mail-in ballots had flaws like a missing date to tell them they had to cast provisional ballots in person. "We're not really MAGA-looking," one of the women said, but they were staunch Trump supporters. "The women voting solely on abortion make me crazy," Ziemba said. "I'd gladly give up my abortion rights and my daughter's for my son not to have to go to war. We'll have peace with Trump." Another woman, Leanne McDermott, who owns a real estate appraisal business with her husband John, thinks the economy will improve under Trump. "With the interest rates high, no one was refinancing." On Election Day, most of the state's counties shifted further to the right, tilting Pennsylvania and its 19 Electoral College votes to Trump by about 130,000 votes. Just over 152,000 total ballots were cast in Luzerne County, about the same as in 2020. But Trump increased his margin to 20 points from 14. In only one other Pennsylvania county were Trump's gains greater. For Democrats, it was a devastating result. "This is scary to me," Constance Wynn said. She had downloaded Project 2025. I need to understand what he's planning to do. She was sitting in the front parlor of her Wilkes Barre home, built by her great-great-grandfather. Wynne's ancestors escaped slavery by fleeing to Pennsylvania before the Civil War. The morning after the election, some of the bikers for Trump gathered to celebrate at Dee's Diner in the Wilkes Barre suburb of Plains Township. A man they did not know, a retired financial planner named Kim Pace, approached their table. He began by saying that his wife did not think it was a good idea to talk to them. He had voted for Harris. "Congratulations, guys," he said. "I hope it all works out." His tone suggested that he was doubtful. Dave Reagan, a U.S. Army veteran who had arrived on his motorcycle, stood up to respond. "We changed the world," he said. "I don't have to worry about my stepdaughter having a boy in the locker room." "Let me tell you something," Pace said. "That stuff is overblown." He wished them well and left. Away from the table, he said, if Harris had won, there was going to be trouble. In the days after the election, political tensions lingered in the community. On Thursday evening, John McDermott, a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve, sat at home with his wife, Leanne, drinking a vodka and tonic after a round of golf. McDermott voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016 and Trump in 2020. This year, he voted for Harris. "I couldn't bring myself to vote for him," he said. "He's a convicted felon. He believes in conspiracy theories." Leanne, a county council member, saw matters differently. She was one of the women making calls at Jennifer Ziemba's house on the eve of the election. Now she was on her way to meet some of them at a restaurant to toast Trump's win. The mood was festive when McDermott arrived. "We're getting Trumpy," one of the women explained as they raised their cosmopolitans and glasses of wine. Among the revelers was Shelley Masur, the wife of Representative Dan Masur, whose district includes a part of Luzerne County. "We got our county back," shouted Terry Eckert, who is a real estate agent. 30 miles down the road from Wilkes Barre is Luzerne County's other city, Hazleton. Its population of 30,000 is 63% Latino, an estimated 90% of whom are from the Dominican Republic. Trump won the city decisively, increasing his share of its vote from 2020 by 7 points, substantially more than the 1.9 points he gained statewide. The community is generally low-income, church-going, and conservative. Adaris Casado, who is at Ada's Collection, the local store she owns, said that her religion and a conviction that Trump shares her values led her to vote for him. "I'm worried about gay marriage," she said, "and transgender." Fredolina Paredes, a paraprofessional at the nearby high school, was at home the weekend after the election with her 3 children and husband, who works in a plastics factory. She has voted for Democrats in the past, including Hillary Clinton, before voting for Trump twice. One of her brothers, a first-time voter, also voted for Trump. Paredes said the Democrats no longer represent her values, especially on the issue of abortion. She was upset about the economy, saying she just spent $9.99 for a package of grapes. For grapes, can you imagine that? Like others in Hazleton, she supported Trump's immigration policies, including deportation plans. "I feel bad for the ones I've known," she said, "friends who have been here for 15 or 20 years. But you were here all that time. Why didn't you try to get your papers?" There are at least 6 Catholic churches and many Pentecostal congregations in the community. One of them is the Iglesia Cristiana Agua de Vida, Hazleton, where Elizabeth Torres is the pastor. Torres voted for Trump and made every effort to persuade her parishioners to do the same. "It wasn't difficult," she said. "He is always talking about God and the Bible," she said through an interpreter. "He only has God in his mouth." She also supported Trump's immigration policies. There are church members who are undocumented, she said, but she was convinced they would be deported only if they commit crimes. One of those undocumented members of the congregation is Wadon Fernandez, who has relatives in Hazleton, and said he came to the United States about 2 years ago to start a new life. He has overstayed his tourist visa and has been working in construction and other jobs. I love Mr. Trump, Fernandez said. Of course he could send me back at any moment, but if he did, I would still love him. Michael Sokolov, who wrote this article, is a contributing writer for the magazine. He has written extensively on Pennsylvania and its politics. And now our next article. Ozempic could crush the junk food industry, but it is fighting back. As revolutionary new weight loss drugs turn consumers off ultra-processed foods, the industry is on the hunt for new products. This article was written by Thomas Weber. Trinian Taylor, a 52-year-old car dealer, pushed his cart through the aisles of a supermarket as I pretended not to follow him. It was a bright August day in Northern California, and I had come to the store to meet Emily Auerbach, a relationship manager at Matson, a food innovation firm that creates products for the country's largest food and beverage companies, McDonald's and White Castle, PepsiCo, and Hostess. Auerbach was trying to understand the shopping behavior of Ozempic users, and Taylor was one of her case studies. She instructed me to stay as close as I could without influencing his route around the store. In her experience, if shop-alongs, too much space, or taking photos would be a red flag for the supermarket higher-ups who might figure out we were not here to shop. They'd be like, "You need to exit," she said. Auerbach watched in silence as Taylor, who was earning $150 in exchange for being tailed, propelled his cart through snack aisles scattered with products from Matson's clients. He took us straight past the Doritos and the Hostess Ho-Hos without a side glance at the Oreos or the Cheetos. We rushed past the Pop-Tarts and the Hershey's Kisses, the Lucky Charms and the Lay's. They all barely registered. Clumsily, close on his heels, Auerbach and I stumbled right into what has become, under the influence of the revolutionary new diet drug, Taylor's happy place, the produce section. He inspected the goods. "I'm on all of these," he told us. "I eat a lot of pineapple, cucumber, ginger, oh, a lot of ginger." Taylor, who lives in Hayward, California, used to nurse a sugar addiction, he said, but he could no longer stomach Hostess treats. A few days earlier, his daughter fed him some candy. "I just couldn't," he said. "It was so sweet, it choked me." His midnight snack used to be cereal, but now he stirs at night with strange urges. Salads, chicken. He has sworn off canned sodas and fruit juices and infuses his water with lemon and cucumber. He dropped a heavy bag of lemons into the cart and sauntered over to the leafy vegetables. "I love Swiss chard," he said. "I eat a lot of kale." For decades, Big Food has been marketing products to people who can't stop eating, and now, suddenly, they can. The active ingredient in Ozempic, as in Wegovy, Zepbound, and several other similar new drugs, mimics a natural hormone called glucagon-like peptide 1, GLP-1, that slows digestion and signals fullness to the brain. Around 7 million Americans now take a GLP-1 drug, and Morgan Stanley estimates that by 2035, the number of U.S. users could expand to 24 million. That's more than double the number of vegetarians and vegans in America, with ample room to balloon from there. More than 100 million American adults are obese, and the drugs may eventually be rolled out to people without diabetes or obesity, as they seem to tame addictions beyond food, appearing to make cocaine, alcohol, and cigarettes more resistible. Research is at an early stage, but they may also cut the risk of everything from stroke and heart and kidney disease to Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. The prospect of tens of millions of people cutting their caloric intake down to roughly 1,000 per day, which is half the minimum amount recommended for men, is unsettling the industry. Late last year, Lars Fruergaard Jorgensen, the chief executive of Novo Nordisk, which makes Ozempic and Wegovy, told Bloomberg that food industry executives had been calling him. "They are scared about it," he said. Around the same time, Walmart's chief executive in the United States, John Furner, said that customers on GLP-1s were putting less food into their carts. Sales are down in sweet baked goods and snacks, and the industry is weathering a downturn. By one market research firm's estimate, food and drink innovation in 2024 reached an all-time nadir, with fewer new products coming to market than ever before. Ozempic users like Taylor aren't just eating less, they're eating differently. GLP-1 drugs seem not only to shrink appetite, but to rewrite people's desires. They attack what Amy Bentley, a food historian and professor at New York University, calls the industrial palate, the set of preferences created by our acclimatization, often starting with baby food, to the tastes and textures of artificial flavors and preservatives. Patients on GLP-1 drugs have reported losing interest in ultra-processed foods, products that are made with ingredients you wouldn't find in an ordinary kitchen, colorings, bleaching agents, artificial sweeteners, and modified starches. Some users realize that many packaged snacks they once loved now taste repugnant. "Wegovy destroyed my taste buds," a Redditor wrote on a support group, adding, "and I love it." The day before I followed Taylor around the supermarket, I sat in on a focus group facilitated by Mattson's Consumer Insights team, listening to people describe how the weight loss drugs have transformed their cravings. Larry Wins, a 69-year-old from Pittsburgh, Kansas, who joined via video call, described being emptied of desire for what he used to love. "Before Wegovy," said Wins, who is now 35 pounds lighter than he was in the spring, "his whole life was fast foods. Now, my first place I hit when I get to the store is produce," he said. "My favorite is Mount Rainier cherries and apples, peaches, pears." Most of the other participants felt like that. Almost everyone's cravings for ultra-processed foods had been replaced with a lust for fresh and unpackaged alternatives. A 32-year-old scientist who works in a university chemistry department spoke about discovering for the first time the true flavor of food. "Celery tastes like celery," she told the group, "and carrot tastes like carrot. Strawberry tastes like strawberry." "Since taking Wegovy," she said, "I just started to realize that they taste wonderful by themselves." Kathleen Kenny, a 54-year-old who runs a sword fighting school in Kansas City, Missouri, said at the focus group that she has always been heavy. "I was the child of people who lived through the Depression," she told me later, "a clean-your-plate kind of family." With the help of a sequence of different weight loss drugs, Kenny has lost more than 100 pounds. "And it has been easy," she said, "because the treatments have transformed her experience of flavor and mouthfeel. A ho-ho no longer seems like food. It tastes plasticky," she said, "or feels plasticky in my mouth." Freed from her addiction, Kenny believes that she can now taste the true ho-ho. She can perceive what Hostess treats, loaded with sugar, actually are. Jennifer Pagano, Mattson's Director of Insights and Artificial Intelligence, was leading the focus group. "It sounds like, you know, I'm hearing from all of you. It's the simple pleasures of food, food in its natural state," she said. "Interesting." Major food companies are scrambling to research the impact of the drugs on their brands and figure out how to adjust. The whole field is still a little stunned, Ashley Gearhart, a food addiction researcher and psychology professor at the University of Michigan, told me over the phone. But for Mattson, which for nearly 50 years has invented products for the nation's biggest food conglomerates, the Ozempic threat could be a boon. I first walked into Mattson's glassy facility by the San Francisco airport on a beautiful Bay Area morning this summer. Barb Stuckey, the company's chief innovation and marketing officer, who describes herself as a hypertaster and whose tongue can detect changes in barometric pressure, greeted me in the hall carrying an armful of milk cartons. I followed her through the lab, past scientists experimenting with gummies and blitzing high-protein smoothies and carrot soup, out back to the trophy wall. On the shelves were rows of packages and bottles for products that Mattson had either dreamed up or helped scale and shepherd to market. There were deep-fried chocolate Hostess Twinkies, not something I would put in my body, Stuckey said. Hungry Man frozen meals and arrays of frozen entrees, ice creams, and condiments from America's largest brands. We invent the future of food, one product at a time, read a sign on the wall. Big Food is practiced at spotting perverse openings for new products in our faddish drives for self-improvement. In 1978, for example, Heinz bought Weight Watchers, added products like cheesecake, and made a tidy profit. That acquisition heralded a trend of health-conscious rebranding that peaked in the 1980s and 90s. Nestle started Lean Cuisine, and Chef America began selling Lean Pockets alongside its Hot Pockets. The difference between the two was roughly 30 calories. ConAgra Brands introduced Healthy Choice, a diet-conscious frozen entree brand. McDonald's made McLean Deluxe Hamburgers. Nabisco came out with Snackwell's fat-free cookies. The public's obsession with weight loss has led to the industry's concocting some very weird substances. In 1996, PepsiCo released potato chips fried in an indigestible fat substitute called Olestra that, miraculously, had zero calories. One problem: Olestra impeded the absorption of essential vitamins. Another, it caused fecal incontinence. The substance is now used to paint decks and lubricate power tools. By the time the owner of Carl's Jr. and Cinnabon got around to buying the rights to the Atkins diet in 2010, interest in fad diets was starting to wane, and Big Food pivoted. The industry increasingly pushed foods enhanced with protein and fiber, or with herbs and minerals and antioxidants and vitamins, a trend that continues today. Despite scant evidence that eating ultra-processed products infused with individual nutrients makes people healthier, there is little the industry hasn't tried to keep health-conscious consumers eating. Companies conceal clouds of nostalgic aromas into packaging to trigger Proustian reverie. When they discovered that noisier chips induced people to eat more of them, snack engineers turned up the crunch. Food technologists found a way to amplify the intensity of artificial sweeteners to hundreds of times beyond sugar's natural flavor. The structure of salt crystals can be altered to accelerate the speed at which they absorb into chemical pathways that signal saltiness, allowing the brain to perceive the flavor more intensely. In the chemosensory world, says Dan Wesson, the director of the Florida Chemical Senses Institute, referring to the science of how chemicals provoke sensations, almost anything is possible. Dullness has its uses, too. Companies make products like potato chips, popcorn, and mac and cheese meals bland on purpose to bypass sensory-specific satiety, the feeling when strongly flavored foods become less desirable as they are eaten. Big Food plumbed behavioral research for clues to how the brain's reward system reacts to sugar and salt, using it to keep products tickling the bliss point, the height of delight. But there is no equivalent bliss point for fat. Fortunately for the industry, people tend to want as much fat as they can get. Scientists can engineer fats to melt at precisely the right temperature in the mouth, sparking the release of dopamine while creating an impression of vanishing caloric density. A Cheeto, disintegrating innocently on the tongue, tells us it contains fewer calories than it does. The more they get away from the actual food and into the convenience of the packaging, the better they do, Robert Moskow, a food industry analyst who works at the investment bank TD Cowen, told me. But many chemicals used in industrial processing can taste unpleasant, metallic, or bitter. Flavor companies like the U.S.-based International Flavors and Fragrances create masking compounds to cover up those off notes. But those chemicals, it turns out, can taste weird, too. The industry's solution is masking compounds that cover up the tastes of the original masking compounds. I feel like I'm constantly defending big food, Stuckey told me when I brought up the industry's history. And perhaps she is right to be. Eating is more convenient now, and it can be cheap. Poor harvests don't have nearly the same impact that they might have in the past. Breakthroughs in processing that made possible products like dehydrated chicken soups, frozen French fries, and Jell-O instant puddings helped reduce domestic burdens on, for the most part, women, many of whom then entered the workforce. In 1947, at a time when food processing was in its early days, Americans were spending nearly a quarter of their disposable incomes on food. Last year, that figure was only 11%, and inflation was running high. The trade-off is obesity. Caloric consumption per capita in the United States has plateaued since 2000, while Americans have slightly intensified their physical activity. At the same time, the obesity rate has swelled by more than a third. Probably the culprit is the food. Ultra-processed products, the consumption of which has increased over the last 25 years, are often highly refined and rich in starch and sugar. We digest them quickly in the stomach and small intestine before they get to the colon, which is home to the gut microbiome. As emerging research shows, when we eat unprocessed or minimally processed foods, our gut bacteria consume as much as 22% of the energy. With ultra-processed products, our bodies soak up all 100% of the calories. Right now, the industry's adaption to Ozempic is in its infancy. A few companies have tested the waters. Nestle, for example, has started a line of frozen meals targeted at people taking GLP-1s called Vital Pursuit. Frozen pizzas, sandwich melts, and chicken bowls with a sharper focus on smaller portions. But reliable data about how GLP-1s reshape people's likes and dislikes is yet to come. While Ozempic is threatening to turn off the industrial palate, Mattson believes that industrial foods may just need to be tweaked. Though many ultra-processed foods and drinks turn off a lot of GLP-1 users, some are breaking through. On GLP-1 forums, people celebrate Fairlife, a line of sweet protein shakes owned by Coca-Cola. And Mattson has already dreamed up an arsenal of other potential winners. In a glass-walled conference room, Mattson scientists prepared for me some of its foods tailored to GLP-1 users that are currently being conceptualized. Amanda Sinrod, a senior food scientist in a white lab coat, placed a plate of soft brown cubes on the table. She explained that she had enriched each Nourish Fit brownie bite with 2 grams of whey protein for maintaining lean muscle mass during rapid weight loss. A peanut butter swirl would push that protein level even higher. Whey protein can have a grainy texture and chalky off notes, but the Nourish Fits were defectless, smooth and sweet, with remote echoes of cocoa. approximately 1/3 sugar and about 15% fat, the bite-sized portions were self-limiting, Sinrod said. Servings could be packaged individually. Then there was a chicken stick wrapped in see-through plastic that looked like a riff on string cheese. A supercharged mozzarella stick, Sinrod said. It had 13 grams of protein and its grill lines were real, for now. To scale up, the quadrillage or char marks might be faked using caramel coloring. It was a grown-up rendition of a classic kid's snack, Sinrod said, that an adult could throw in a purse. It tasted felicitously of citrus. GLP-1 users report craving fresh, acidic flavors. A small cardboard tub of salty, freeze-dried chicken soup was followed by no-carb tacos, also chicken, with an endive leaf taking the role of the tortilla. Taco Bell could go for this, said Stucky, who was sitting on the other side of the table and watching me eat. To wash it down, a translucent protein shake in psychedelic purple with lashings of sweetener and lingering medicinal notes of berry. There were other snacks, too, that were at an even more embryonic stage, including burgers, a blend of frozen vegetables and seasonings to jazz up turkey meat, a 2-ounce portion of yogurt that you could squeeze from a pouch like baby puree, strawberry sensation, mango magic, blueberry bliss, each 6 grams of protein, and something called satiety gum in 4 flavors, crisp green apple, watermelon fresh mint, cinnamon red hot mama, and minty fresh metabolism. My Ozempic optimized banquet was fine. It was fine, but compared with ripe Rainier cherries, I feared Larry Wins might have found it a little dull. The mild flavor profiles and engineered textures of Mattson's inventions were similar to existing packaged foods like Betty Crocker cake mixes and Tyson grilled and ready chicken strips. Were products like this enough, I wondered, to break through Ozempic's defenses and excite people whose relationship to food has been turned on its head? GLP-1 drugs change far more than our metabolic processes. There are GLP-1 receptors in the hypothalamus, the area that regulates hunger and signals fullness, and in the brain's dopamine reward system, the primitive so-called reptilian desire circuitry involved with addictive behaviors. It seems that GLP-1s, by regulating the release of dopamine, may make the flavor profiles of ultra-processed products, many of which have been optimized to stimulate the brain's reward system, less appealing. Does Ozempic shatter the illusion that junk tastes good by turning down the dopamine hit? Data is lacking. The drugs, said Gearhart, the Michigan food addiction researcher, are still a black box. Mattson is betting on convenience winning out. Although Larry Wins is now buying mainly fruits and vegetables, he still turns to healthy choice frozen meals in a pinch. That's no surprise to Bob Nolan, a senior vice president at ConAgra Brands, the line's owner and a Mattson client. As people eat less, he wagers, the value of convenience will grow. You're probably not going to want to be in the kitchen prepping an elaborate meal to just have a few bites, Nolan told me. Eating fewer calories makes it harder to obtain the nutrients we need, said Auerbach, the Mattson relationship manager, so selling products pumped full of protein and fiber makes sense. Given Big Food's track record, it's likely that the companies will succeed at finding products Ozempic users crave. But what if they're too successful? I asked Nicole Avena, a professor of neuroscience at Mount Sinai, who studies sugar addiction, if she believed it could be possible for food companies to engineer, intentionally or not, compounds that would make GLP-1 drugs less effective. Avena told me it was plausible. The food industry, she pointed out, has cabinets of formidable reward-triggering compounds with which to experiment. Companies could end up counteracting the drugs to some degree in their efforts to make foods more rewarding, she said. I asked Matson's chief executive, Justin Shymuck, an easygoing, Ursine, Minnesota native with a PhD in food science, if he worried about that possibility. Shymuck's first job before he drove his motorcycle from the Midwest to California was working for General Mills on Lucky Charms. Foams are his forte. He helped invent the chemical formulas that make marshmallows change color or reveal hidden images upon their contact with milk. But making GLP-1 products for Shymuck is also personal. He has struggled with his weight since childhood. Near the beginning of this year, he started taking a GLP-1 drug. His food noise, the droning monotone of want that torments many who end up on the drugs, has since vanished, along with more than 50 pounds. He no longer craves sugary lattes. Shymuck, who is in talks with the biggest of the big food companies about designing GLP-1 optimized products, said he was not anxious about big foods trying to overwhelm the brains of GLP-1 users with hyper-rewarding compounds. Taste and pleasure are very important, said Shymuck, who seemed to be choosing his words carefully, but not the only thing. There is an honest desire in the industry, he added, to support people in their weight loss journeys. Shymuck wouldn't say which companies he is speaking to about GLP-1 products. We are professional secret keepers, he said. Stuckey had her team think about companies that might be a natural fit for their optimized creations for GLP-1 users. As I was finishing up my Ozempic-inspired lunch, they started throwing around ideas. Could the Nourish Fit brownie become a high-protein cake mix sold by Betty Crocker, a General Mills brand? Or Hostess, Stuckey said, could easily start a GLP-1 line. Nobody would know it was from Hostess. Because GLP-1 side effects include gastrointestinal issues, how about reaching out to General Mills, the owners of Fiber One, Stuckey said, and offering to help it design products targeted to GLP-1 users? A 40-something restaurant owner from Pennsylvania had explained to his fellow participants in the Matson Focus Group that, since starting on Wegovy, he now has to force himself to eat. Beef jerky is one thing that's just about bearable, but his fiber levels are way down, so Stuckey suggested a jerky infused with a fiber source. Maybe inulin? Maybe psyllium husk? That is a really disgusting idea, she said, but we're good at making things taste good. Thomas Weber, who wrote this article, is a writer who lives in London. He has written about orcas attacking yachts, an inventor who fell in love with his AI, and a tiny Scottish village betting its future on rocket launches. And I would now like to take a moment to remind you that you are listening to the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And surprisingly, we still have time for another article. So again, from this edition of the New York Times Magazine, America's Split Screen on Abortion. The abortion rights movement won in many states, even some that voted for Donald Trump. Where does it go from here? This article was written by Emily Bazelon. In the first few elections after the Supreme Court's 2022 reversal of Roe v. Wade, the abortion rights movement created reason for hope among its supporters. It won a string of unexpected victories in ballot measures from conservative states like Kansas and Ohio to moderate ones like Michigan. Then came November 5th. On election day, the movement hit a ceiling. Voters said yes to measures to protect abortion access in 7 states, including Arizona, Missouri, and Nevada. But 3 other measures failed, including one in Florida, which had strong majority support, but couldn't clear the state's unusual 60% threshold for passage. And from the point of view of both supporters and opponents of abortion rights, the most important result of the night was the loss of Kamala Harris, who ran on defending abortion access, to Donald Trump, who said of Roe's reversal, "I'm proud to have done it." Remember when the overturning of Roe was supposed to cause a landslide Democrat victory? Kristen Hawkins, the president of Students for Life of America, shared on X. LOL. The distinction voters made between abortion as a standalone issue and abortion as a factor in deciding who should lead the country was clear in states like Montana, Florida, Missouri, and Nevada. Trump won these states even as abortion rights measures also commanded majorities. In a sense, it's not surprising that the democratic process would yield mixed and even contradictory results. Many of Harris's supporters cared deeply about abortion rights. Before the electorate at large, the issue was one among many to consider in deciding whom to vote for, ranking below the economy, crime, immigration, and other concerns. "It wasn't a top issue for the country," said Trezza Undem of the public opinion research firm Perry Undem. "It was a top issue for certain groups, like women of reproductive age." The election results demonstrate that since Dobbs v. Jackson, Women's Health Organization, the Supreme Court ruling in 2022 that overturned Roe, the abortion landscape has become a split screen. Confronting the issue of ending a pregnancy in all its complexity, voters have largely chosen to put the decision in the hands of women, not the government. Sometimes they've recognized abortion rights in their state constitutions as integral to gender equality and freedom. The next 4 years, however, could demonstrate the limits of the state-by-state democratic strategy. For almost 50 years, Roe gave abortion access the stability and scope of a constitutional foundation. The Supreme Court had almost never taken away a civil right once granted, so many Americans assumed the ruling was unassailable. But Roe always had an uneasy relationship with popular will. When the ruling went into effect in 1973, abortion was entirely legal in only 4 states. 13 more had fairly broad exceptions to bans, and others had such provisions in the works. Dobbs demonstrated the peril of relying on 9 justices, rather than passing laws backed by voters, to guarantee what many people considered a basic liberty, but others saw as a sin and a crime. Soon, near-total bans went into effect in 15 states, and clinics shut down. As patients scrambled to find care somewhere, access seemed not only diminished across hundreds of miles, but even doomed. The ballot measures came next. Ballot initiatives sponsored by citizens began more than a century ago as a small-d democracy reform of the progressive era. Today, 26 states allow some form of citizen-sponsored measures. They are a means of making government more responsive when elected officials fail to reflect the will of the people. In states where a majority of voters support access to abortion but have elected Republican officials and lawmakers who do not, a ballot measure can eliminate a ban or severe restriction. In states under Democratic control, the initiatives can enshrine a right in the state constitution, a more durable protection than a regular statute. For abortion access activists, going straight to voters with citizen-sponsored initiatives, direct democracy, was a deliberate strategy, but also a gamble. State measures require armies of canvassers to collect signatures to get onto the ballot, followed by piles of cash for ads. When a senior attorney at Planned Parenthood told me shortly after the Dobbs decision that her organization saw state initiatives as their best bet for helping patients maintain access, I was skeptical. But the politics of abortion were shifting significantly for the first time in decades. The share of people who thought their state should broadly allow abortion rose to 61% from 49% before Dobbs, according to nationwide polls by AP NORC. Rooting abortion in the democratic process has given the issue renewed force. Another important civil right, same-sex marriage, followed this path, originating in state court decisions, laws, and ballot measures before the Supreme Court guaranteed it as a national right in 2015. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the feminist Supreme Court justice who died in 2020, criticized Roe for forestalling a state-by-state legal shift. In a 2013 interview, she regretted that Roe seemed to have stopped the momentum on the side of change. It was a position she'd long held. In 1985, she wrote a Law Review article lamenting that before the ruling, majoritarian institutions were listening and acting. Though no one would wish for it, stories of tragedy have become an important means of persuading Americans to vote to protect abortion. A TV ad for Amendment 4 in Florida, which would have lifted the state's 6-week ban, featured a woman who was diagnosed with terminal cancer. Before Dobbs, she had an abortion at about 20 weeks so she could have chemotherapy. Florida has now banned abortion even in cases like mine, she said. The Harris campaign ran an ad about Amber Thurman, a 28-year-old in Georgia who died after waiting 20 hours for treatment after a medication abortion because doctors feared violating the state's 6-week ban. "My daughter is gone because of what Donald Trump did," Thurman's mother says in the ad, which cuts to him taking credit for reversing Roe. "We will never get Amber back, but we can make sure this never happens again." The messaging was aimed at voters who have nuanced views on abortion that often aren't captured by polls. Angela Cuffler, a partner at Global Strategy Group, which runs message testing for abortion rights campaigns, told me about a voter in a focus group who listened to women's stories and moved from opposing abortion entirely to allowing that there could be valid reasons for it, like health problems or rape, and then landed on the view that the government shouldn't interfere with people's personal decision-making. 73% of independent voters who heard stories of near death from untreated pregnancy complications because of abortion bans said abortion would impact their vote in the 2024 elections, compared with 21% of those who hadn't heard such stories, according to a report by Perry Undum in June. These were independents who said that abortion should be legal in some cases. But the stories broke through unevenly. Only 16% of Republican voters heard them, Perry Undum found. Nationally, voters' sense of urgency about restoring rights may have been dampened by a surprising post-Dobbs development. The number of abortions actually rose slightly between 2020 and the end of 2023, even in most states that have banned abortion, according to the most comprehensive account since Dobbs, which the New York Times covered last month. Women have replaced visits to in-state clinics with travel or abortion pills they order online. The pills have become more readily available since doctors in states like New York and California began writing mail-order prescriptions across state lines, protected by what are known as shield laws, which promise that a provider's home state won't cooperate if she is investigated by a state with a ban. The campaigns for pro-access ballot measures have also contended with hardball tactics from Republican officials who use their control of state offices to fight alongside abortion opponents. In Arkansas, election officials blocked an abortion measure from going to voters by rejecting signatures, saying that the campaign hadn't submitted proper documentation. The state Supreme Court, dominated by conservatives, agreed. In Missouri, when the state auditor estimated that changing the state's state constitution to protect abortion would cost the state $51,000 a year, Attorney General Andrew Bailey withheld his approval, saying that the cost could exceed $12 billion annually. The state Supreme Court rejected Bailey's position. In Florida, where supporters of Amendment 4 raised more than $100 million, far more than opponents, Governor Ron DeSantis joined the fight. DeSantis, a Republican, allocated millions in taxpayer funds to the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration to run ads claiming that Amendment 4 would harm women and children. At the same time, the Florida Health Department, which is run by a DeSantis-appointed Surgeon General, sent letters to TV stations threatening criminal charges for running the ad featuring the woman with terminal cancer, claiming it would confuse patients and thus amounted to an unsanitary nuisance. It's hard to call such tactics successful, given that Amendment 4 won 57% of the vote, but it's possible they peeled off enough voters to make the initiative fall short of the required 60% supermajority. Trump's election, alongside Republican control of the House and the Senate, could be even more consequential for abortion access than Dobbs has been so far. During the campaign, Trump backed away from his previous support for a national 15-week ban, which helps explain why many voters who want abortion to be mostly legal said they supported him, according to pre-election polls. Some abortion opponents credit him with neutralizing the issue politically, admitting that a national limit is unlikely to pass, and pointing out there are plenty of other actions he can take as president. Trump's avowal that the states now have it and people can make their own decisions within the states doesn't address how much this hinges on the choices of a presidential administration, especially for the availability of abortion pills. To begin with, Trump has promised to appoint judges who are as conservative as those he elevated in his first term, and his control of federal agencies could directly reduce access to abortion pills. He can nominate a commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration who orders a reversal of the agency's approval for mailing the abortion medication mifepristone. The White House could also allow enforcement of the Comstock Act, an 1873 law that makes it a federal crime to send or receive anything that causes an abortion, provisions that have been dormant for nearly a century. Trump's Justice Department could reverse the long-standing practice of federal authorities and open the door to prosecuting people who mail and receive abortion pills. These would be radical changes. Access to abortion pills is very popular, according to polls. But Trump is unpredictable, and given the election results, abortion opponents may feel emboldened about trying to persuade him. For a time, the power Trump and his anti-abortion allies wield in Washington will overshadow everything else, but activists say they will continue to work at a local level, even though incremental strategies for change are inherently slow and often piecemeal. Not every state is poised to win in one cycle, said Sarah Standiford, the national campaign director for Planned Parenthood Action Fund, which helped raise the money for Amendment 4. We have to look at every angle, but with the losses of some candidates this week who supported reproductive health, we know that ballot measures will continue to be extremely important to protect and restore abortion in the states. In 10 states where abortion is banned or severely restricted, citizen-sponsored ballot initiatives aren't available, so advocates will have to consider other routes, like chipping away at bans with lawsuits and proposing legislation. Harris's supporters credit her with revitalizing abortion access as a political issue. She made it front and center in a way no Democratic presidential candidate had before, said Michelle Colon, the executive director of the Reproductive Justice Group, SheRoe, in Mississippi. Abortion rights have especially high support among young people, suggesting that eventually democracy could return to women what Dobbs took away. Carol Joffe, a sociologist who has studied reproductive health for over 40 years, is finishing a forthcoming book, After Dobbs, How the Supreme Court Ended Roe But Not Abortion, with her co-author David S. Cohen. "We're writing the epilogue now," Joffe said. "We will point out that abortion is a historical constant. Dobbs has caused death and injury and misery, and in light of the election, we could see more of that. But the political pendulum in the U.S. will swing back." Emily Bazelon, who wrote this article, is a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine. With the couple minutes we have remaining, I will read to you from the comments section associated with this article, where readers have written in to respond to the article, and these are the readers' picks. The first one is from Jay, who wrote, "Anyone who voted for their own state's abortion rights and then voted for Trump was foolish and deluded. Please take time to find what the white nationalist Christian leaders are saying since Trump won. In a nutshell, they believe electoral success means they now have a divine mission and ability under Trump in the next 4 years to remake our nation into their white Christian power-ruled dominion, where women are totally subordinate to their husbands and neither contraception nor abortion is legal. Their views on the rights of LGBTQ Americans are equally medieval and dangerous. The chilling post by Nick Fuentes, a white nationalist and Trump ally, put it succinctly: your body, my choice, forever." And from Jerry Grady in Cherokee, North Carolina, "Obviously, it's not just abortion. It's women's health and the place of women in society. Women's rights are being crushed under this resurgence of patriarchy, and when women's rights are crushed, so are the rights of the children and the rest of those who are not white men. It's brutal." And finally from Spencer in St. Louis, "Get back with us in a year. Let us know if your supposed tax break will cover the increased cost of groceries. Once the Trump and his Republican cronies have initiated tariffs and ran all of the workers who pick produce and work in the meat processing plants out of the country, expect to pay $10 for a head of lettuce and $30 per pound for hamburger. The issue of bodily autonomy for women is important. Sorry you don't see it that way." And that is all the time we have for this edition of the New York Times Magazine program. I'm Julie Mink, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you very much for joining me, and please join me again for the New York Times Magazine program.